Now speak.
Tape 3, side 1. We are interviewing Mr. Leon Arcus.
Okay.
The only thing I want to say at this point is that after seeing poverty, and by the way, when people keel over in the streets, it's hard for me to say now. It's hard to envision this. Yet, you got to the point after years, you stepped over them. You've got to understand, you become inured to a certain amount, and it always astounds me when I think back about it, because I can't imagine my doing this. And yet, it's part of the game, or survival.
You have to protect yourself.
I speak of all of this because I went to the Bank Mali and saw the Shah's gems. Now, this is something I never got over because when I came out, I was really so revolted. I almost became ill. The rooms were about 60 feet long and about 40 feet wide and consisted of nothing but enormous long refectory tables, practically going the entire width. Oh, each of them about 3 feet wide or maybe 2.5 feet. And nothing but a series of gigantic bowls, glass bowls. Oh, I'd say about 3 feet wide, about a foot high. And one whole table would have bowls with just filled to the top with uncut emeralds. Next would be rubies and so forth. Against the wall were these, what would you call them, wooden sort of spikes coming out, which were just jammed full of fantastic pearls. But how many thousands of ropes of pearls were there? I don't know. And you know, the funny thing is, you can look at a gem and sort of feel interest and get excited about it, maybe. But when you see this mass, it's revolting.
It's unconscionable.
It really is hard. And you realize, if you can get one of these and put it in your pocket, you are made for life, practically. These emeralds, I'll never forget them, they were chunks.
Huh.
And the moment you walked outside, you saw all that filth and all the beggars and everything else. You thought, I mean, this whole thing became nonsense. It was like it's a child's play. The whole thing is unreal. It's an unreal situation.
What type of educational system did they have there, if any?
Strange. I don't know much about lower education. But obviously, the only ones who really can get educated would have to be in the middle or upper class. There's practically no middle class, by the way. They are the shopkeepers. They're comparatively few. The upper class, well, it's University of Tehran. They even had a medical school there. God knows what they're taught. I don't know.
They manned only by Iranians?
Mostly. We never met anybody but Iranians there, so I can't say. Many of them, the upper class, of course, went to Europe. Many of them were educated. Mostly they were educated in Switzerland. I'd met the Shah, the young Shah, and that time that was, what's her name? His first wife, who, what's her name? Began with an F. She was the sister of Farouk.
Yes.
And,
he divorced her.
Yeah, they were divorced early. She didn't supply a male heir, so he kept on divorcing until he kind of got. At any rate, I mean, the thing gets to be a little, it gets Graustarkian. It does, it becomes unreal. It's an unreal world. Tehran itself is a very, well actually, Tehran is an incredible place because of the light. The light is, somebody once called it the city of striking swords or something like that. It's a glitter. It's a great deal of brilliant light. It's almost too intense. But if in a small aperture in a room, you could light the entire room. You didn't need normal light. And it's interesting. It's a curious city. It's a combination of everything. You see, Mohammedans are not supposed to drink. There are bars all over Tehran. And nightclubs. The nightclubs always played Latin American music. It's an interesting sort of thing. I once figured out why. Because, you know, the Iranians are the true Aryans. Iran comes out of the word Aryan, or Aryan comes out. And they have more Semitic features than any other group I know of. Enormous hooked noses. Their skin is very swarthy, and I guess the reason for the Latin American music was that they could pass, it's the nearest thing that would give them their step upward.
Well, it's hard to reconcile Iranians with nightclubs because they are so rigid.
Tehran is, well, now wait a minute. I left there before Khomeini.
Yes. What years were you there?
I left in 45.
Oh, this is all before
Khomeini. And you were there for how long?
I arrived there in 42.
That accounts for it.
Did you meet any Iranian Jews while you were
there? Yes, surely. Number of them. Matter of fact, if you want to meet them, you can find them all. Most of them are down in New York City at that, what used to be the old decorators building. You know, where you found, they have rug dealers and all of them down around, right above Madison Square. It's on 5th Avenue and 24th Street, I think. An old building
Street.
That was devoted to that exclusively. And they're all in there. In fact, one of them, he comes out here. I used to buy a lot of stuff from him for the shop. What's his name? I'll think of it in a moment. Oh, well.
You mean for the gift shop at the museum?
Gift shop, yeah.
The Iranian
Jews there ran, well, there was a guy named Solomon, S-O-L-E-O-M-E-I-M,
Solomon,
Solomon.
S-O-L.
Forgive me, I can't.
All right.
Put it together. Solomon Rabbi, R-A-B-B-I. And that was, Najat was the guy that ran it, N-E-J-A-T. He had, Rafi was his brother. They had rugs and everything else. They became very good friends, and they were the outstanding dealers in antiquities. And what Najat knew about antiquities is incredible. I used to meet over there with Donald Wilbur and Joe Upton. They were both civilians. Both of them. Well, Don was the man, I hate to say this, who overthrew Mossadegh. He was the United States, OSS, otherwise known as the, what do we call them now, the...
CIA.
And Joe was from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and he, I guess he was OSS, at that time OSS was, you were still a civilian, but you, in the field. And both of them were interested in antiquities. Don was out of Princeton University, And he still is a friend, although I don't love his background. Hi,
morning.
Al.
How are you on, Leon?
All right.
There you go. Yeah, so
thank you very much.
Have a nice day.
I just want to see who's sending me all this. Oh, Brody.
And you met
him? We meet him down at Najat Ravi's, and he would start giving them lectures about stuff they were buying, and he was really quite a wonderful guy. I bought quite a bit from him. I have all my rugs in my house from him. And I understand that Rafi is in America. I've never run into him. I've never been able to do that. But they were perfectly wonderful. The outstanding Iranian scholar of yesteryear was a man named Arthur Upham Pope, P-O-P-E. Pope was the man who did the famous Iranian survey in 7 volumes. He and his wife, Phyllis Ackerman. And I'd met Pope before going over, and it's very funny, I ran into him of all places in Tehran, and I was talking to Najat, when suddenly I realized there's somebody else there, this big tall guy, and knew from the back of him that he had to be an American, and got a look at his face and suddenly realized it was Pope, who recognized me, and I brought him out to the camp, and that was that. It's a very funny story because these things get to be too incidental, but Pope was there with a whole stack of American scientists, people like Langmuir, Shapley of Harvard, all of these outstanding people. Most of them have won Nobel Prize winners, so forth. They had all been sent out by the United States government to go up to Russia and to see what the Russians had. This is towards the end of the war. What the Russians had in the way of laboratories and equipment and so forth for their scientists. The claim was that American scientists claimed that he had too little opportunities to do his work. He had to either become like Langmuir, a member of General Electric, or he got himself a lowly position in a university, and I'm not going to go into that whole situation. And so Pope had taken over the group when they were in Iran, and the moment he told my general that we were all friends, I suddenly was put in charge of this party, and what a time. One of the funniest things is being awakened at 3 o'clock in the morning by this whole bunch of top-notch scientists. All of them wanted to go swimming in our laundry pool, which you're not supposed to. And orders were orders. I would make sure they were happy. And to watch this bunch of fairly elderly scientists skinny dipping into this thing, and I have it. Was a riot. Anyway.
That's quite an experience.
But,
maybe we ought now to, and let's try to set up another date so we can continue.
All right. I told him to double check, guys. Said it'd be worth his while. He went to New York, and I gave him various galleries who dealt with this artist. He's long dead, but I mean, had a particular experience with him. And I said, there's something about this particular painting that irritates me. You know, there's something wrong. You know something, but you can't put your finger on it. Later on, you can give 5,000 reasons, but at that moment you can't. And I gave him all that, then suggested other things and people he might see. And I said, do this before you put out 1 cent. I know he hasn't got the money for this sort of thing. I think the price was in the $70,000 category, you see. And if the picture were good, it would be a very good bargain, by the way. And I don't know what... Later he called me and he said, I'm in deep trouble. I said, what's the matter? He said, I bought the picture. And now I find out that it's not right. I said, well, did you do what I suggested you do? Well, no, I had an idea of writing to so-and-so, who is an authority, has written a great deal on it. I said, fine, but why did you buy the picture before you got any answer? Well, he said, I don't know. The man said he had to sell it. He needed money right away, and I didn't want to lose it. I said, well, instead you lost your money. But, I said, the real problem with you is that your anxiety to make money is so great, the greed element is so strong that you forget that no matter how many people look at a picture, they all have different points of view, and you've got to understand it's not that simple. Nobody can give you a 100% assurance that a picture is right unless he knew the picture terribly well. I think I can judge John Keynes, and I do it all the time, but that's a specialty, you know, about, but you can't. And ever since this happened, I've been very upset because I know he can't afford this. He went out and borrowed that money. And I feel very, very, I don't know why. Did he expect me to give him the final word?
But you cautioned him.
I cautioned him. I said, please, I gave him, step by step, I not only went did that, but I went to my material here and pulled out the addresses and the telephone numbers of every outfit. I said, while you're in New York, you can make 8 stops. It's not that hard, and do it all in one day. I'm trying to save money there. You don't have to stay over. It's a small picture. You can take it under his arm. I still feel very upset about that poor chap. Oh, not because of, I don't know if he'll ever learn anything. The only thing is that
expensive
he can't
lesson.
Afford that picture, and I know that he's got a family. That's a pretty rough experience. And this is what happens. I get it all the time with people that you spend hours of training them and all. When I get clients, you know, I don't just sell pictures. They buy them. And I don't sell stuff I won't touch. I wouldn't touch a Norman Rockwell that I'm writing about. Although I knew him, by the way.
Oh, really?
And a nicer man you'll never find. He never believed his own stuff, you know. He's a highly educated man. Rockwell used to buy bundles of these great big reproductions of old masters. He loved Bruegel, he loved Vermeer and all that. And one day I said to him, why? He said, well, he looked at me sort of, he said, well, where do you think I get my compositions? I was absolutely thrown. Of course, he's been stealing all the arrangements for things. And I'll never forget one day I got a call from him. He said, I'm out here, and I think he said, I'm in St. Louis, and I'm here doing work on a... Oh, doing some drawings of baseball for the season. But he says, I'm really working on a picture for Thanksgiving. You know, they have to work. This is back in the days of the Saturday Evening Post. And he goes into the description of a picture. He talked in a sort of rapid, quick, episodic sort of way. He said, I'm doing a picture of an automat. You know, maybe the one on 57th Street. You know that.
Oh, yeah.
Pause. Now, in a window, there's a boy, and you know it's his grandmother, he says, because it's got to be his grandmother. And the window has a big thing pasted on it, Thanksgiving dinner. Advertising Thanksgiving. And guess what? They're saying grace. pause. Slush, isn't it?
That's right.
Overwhelmed me. I mean, it was, but you know, he's about the only person I know who could carry this sort of Americana, I was going to say garbage, I don't know what to call it, over, you know, the Ross Perot thought, and making Ross Perot just occurs to me. I collected Norman Rockwell. Well, that's the American mentality.
Did he really? Is that one of the things he did?
What's that?
And that's what Perot did?
Well, Perot collected, he has a large collection of Norman Rockwell, and especially of bronzes of Remington, you know, the Western scenes.
Well, he's Texan.
Which was one of the last fights I ever had with the museum, because I refused to put on a Western show, which was the first show put on after I left. I will not do a Buffalo Bill show, not me.
There's a great one in out west, a rodeo
there's
one, show.
There's a famous, the museum that Rockefeller built near, I can't tell you where, but it's right near, oh, it's near, would it be near Cody or is it, no, it's, I don't know. I was out in Grand Tetons and was taken there. And it's a beautiful museum, absolutely beautiful building, just full of all these Western scenes. And frankly, I don't know, there are very few of them. The best Western artist we ever produced was Russell, who I felt, Charlie Russell, was a... was a very ingenious guy, and he was very real. Remington, by the way, was an Eastern, you know, went west. And he took with him all of the restraints and everything else of the East, and I felt was a very academic sort of man. Incidentally, I once saw a painting I never believed. And then I later learned Remington went to Russia, and he painted the Tatars, you know, on horseback and all that. Mm-hmm. And something very weird about it. You look at it and you look at it and you just can't put it together. And suddenly you realize they're all racing across the steps as though they were cowboys in Wyoming. And there's something very ridiculous about the whole thing.
That was his mentality.
It's a weird thing. But Russell had a natural, are you looking something?
My pen is running out.
Yeah.
I have to bring another pen. Okay.
Yeah, how about there's others in here.
All right. Isn't that funny? You come so well prepared.
I thought.
I'll use this one. No, I have it.
I have
okay.
A whole stack
thanks.
Of
I do too. I was looking for my purse.
I can get
there's
them out.
Another one.
I put my purse down. This is fine.
I have one.
Okay. Great. Fine.
Take
fine.
Them all.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Russell really was a cowboy and expressed himself exactly in those terms. The most interesting thing I saw of his was down in Fort Worth. They have his letters, which are very wonderful, because they're all illustrated, little vignettes all over the thing, of explaining in drawings what he's trying to say in speech. And they're fantastic, they're very funny, and they're man of good sense of humor. And I remember many, many years ago, right after the war, going out to Great Falls, Montana. And in Great Falls, they had this enormous, bar called the Mint. It's still there, I guess. And the Mint has the longest bar, I think, in the world. I don't know, but it's enormous. And behind it, the whole place was covered with Charlie Russell pictures. Now they've made a museum out of taking them all out of there. But the Mint was the only vestige I really ever saw or had a feeling about the West, that's all. I mean, you really could, you'd see cowboys come in. And of course, the present-day cowboys no longer like the old ones.
No.
But they are cowboys. Oh, well.
If you recall...
Well, away from all of this, it's not very... It's not my meat, really. What do you want to ask?
I have just a few very foolish questions. You mentioned Rumi Tomb Architect. I don't know the name.
I'll say that again.
Rumi Tomb, you mentioned the architect. I don't know that name.
Rumi Tomb.
I must not have heard it correctly. Early on, you were talking about him, and I didn't know the name.
I don't know who Rumi Tomb would be. I spoke...
All right.
It doesn't
not important. Okay.
I can't get anything out of it.
All right. And you had talked about your mother. We were going to go back and talk about her. Yeah. Remember
we
that?
We decided we were going to
yeah,
get
I remember
the story
that was the last
about
thing.
Your mother today.
Well, as my mother was a very quiet, retiring sort of person. She would never leave the house unless she was fully dressed. By that I mean... as though she were going somewhere, definitely. She was a splendid mother. Now, I'm saying that not because she's my mother, because she had one quality which that astounded me. She always, well, when I was about 15, I guess I was rather mature 15, and I never forget, I went out on a New Year's Eve party, and we went down to Times Square in New York, and it was a very slushy day, and there's nothing like the slush of Times Square or New York after 10,000 cars have gone through it. It is the filthiest, messiest stuff in the world. And one of the couples in our party sort of ran across. We followed sort of stupidly, and the girl I was with began to fall, and I tried to prevent that. The result, I fell. And boy, I was covered with this horrible stuff. Well, I got home that night. Everybody's asleep. I'll never forget, I took my overcoat and put it on the floor and so forth on the way out, so it could all dry, you see. And the next morning, my mother eyed me, and she didn't say a word. But she said, I'm a bit disappointed, you know. That's not the sort of way you've done things. Then I explained what it was all about, and she smiled and said, you know, I'm going to tell you something. You're very mature for your age. And I don't care, from now on, I'm not going to tell you what to do. I will never tell you what to do. Just don't come home sick. Now, I think you know what that meant. It meant, do what you wish. And by the way, she kept her word. She never told me what to do, which took half the fun out of being young. It was a very destructive thing. I had to think for myself and be mature. But I always regarded this as being... She was astounding, because after all, she was brought up very definitely in a very Edwardian home.
Where was she from?
She was from Kiev. And she came to America. She went to gymnasium there. Came to America and married my father when she was about, I have it somewhere, but I think she's around 18, thereabouts. And,
what do you know about
very
her
good
family?
Very good-looking woman, because I still have, I have photos of this period. Big point.
About her family.
Her family? Most of them are strangely younger. It's kind of, it's very funny. They're mostly in the art field. Have you ever heard of a firm that was very famous in Paris, more less so in New York City, called A La Vieille Russie? Have you ever heard of it? It's on Fifth, it's still going. It's on Fifth Avenue and about 60th Street. It's the outstanding old, fine quality Russian antiques and art. It's, if you want, this is where you get your Fabergé. This is where you get anything of any of that rare quality. I've been to the firm in Paris, where their main client for many years was Farouk, of King Farouk. And it did very well. This was part of the family setup. All of my uncles...
Were these your mother's brothers?
Uh-huh.
Who had founded this?
No, the man that founded that was actually my mother's uncle. He was much older. But I'll never forget him. He came to America early in time to get out of Russia, get out of Paris. He was living in Paris. One of the family in Paris had married a Gentile, and so the whole firm was put into her name, and that she saved it all right through the whole war.
What was your mother's family name?
Hoffman, H-O-F-F-M-A-N. Our first name was Elizabeth, called Bess.
That's really more a German.
End of side one, tape three. Continued on side two.